Yeah, so oil sand reclamation in the soil plant microbe plant continuum in Boyle, Alberta. I showed that title to a colleague of mine last week, and she's like, wow, that's really big. And so I'm just going to, the nature of this talk is going to be a review of research that's been going on in my lab for the last 5 years. And it is, as Jay mentioned, it's oil sands, tar sands. As the rest of the world knows, it is kind of a dirty word in Alberta. So just if you're ever in Alberta talking to regulators or operators, it's oil sands. So I'd just like to start off with some acknowledgements. I have a lot of collaborators that work on this, and I'm going to be looking at, as I said, some work that my lab has done in the past 5 years, but other people, there's a lot of work, there's a lot of research opportunities in the oil sands, there's a lot of work being conducted. So my collaborators are working on different things like carbon chemistry, forest ecology, mycorrhizal associations that we just heard about in reclamation are important. That work is being done. Also, microbial molecular work. I have another colleague here today, Brad Pino, working on landscape ecology. And this work has really been conducted by a host of graduate students over the years, technicians, and then funding agencies. NSERC is the Canadian National Science and Engineering Research Council. CONRAD is an industrial group of research of companies that fund research. Syncru Canada is our main industrial partner right now, and the Canada Foundation for Innovation has supplied me with lab analytical equipment. So just to give you some background on oil sands, so we're here, so we have Mexico, the US, Canada, and Alberta is one of the central provinces, prairie provinces. So this is Alberta, and what we can see is Edmonton is about central Alberta. There's still a whole lot of land area north of us in Edmonton. About 6 hours north of Edmonton is Fort McMurray, and that's in the heart of the oil sand region. So in Alberta's oil sand deposits, there's about 1.7 million barrels of bitumen. It's the largest petroleum reserve in the world. It was considered a secondary oil resource up until recently. It's been switched to a primary. And that's significantly changed Canada's economy in the last 5 years. It's Athabasca is the largest of the four deposits. You can see there's Cold Lake deposit, some other deposits here. So I'm going to refer to this as the Athabasca oil sands region, the largest of the four deposits. There's 175 billion barrels that are recoverable by current mining methods. So that means surface mining, very large scale disturbances. And then another 315 billion with technological advances, and that is SAGD operations. It's steam-assisted gravity drainage, where they drill vertically and then horizontally in the ground with two pipes. And the top pipe releases steam, which liquefies the oil, and the bottom pipe collects it, and they pump it up again. And so it's really going to change the landscape over it, and not just the surface mining, which to date there's 750 square kilometers of surface mine disturbance, and there's, I think, up to 3,500 square kilometers of surface mineable area. But then all the SAGD operations are really going to fragment the boreal forest, and there's lots of current concerns for wildlife habitat and fragmentation. And the oil sands industry produces more than 16% of Canada's total petroleum needs, and of course it's in the news every day with the Keystone Pipeline and Northern Gateway Pipeline supplying oil to Asian markets and U.S. markets. Just to give you a little bit more information on the nature of this reserve, oil sands can appear near the surface on the banks of the Athabasca River. So even Sir Alexander Mackenzie wrote about it in his travel diaries as far back as 1788. So you can see this is a historic picture of this is bitumen deposits on the banks of the Athabasca River. And so that represents another problem I won't talk about today, just talking about hydrocarbon contamination or metal contamination in the environment. It's hard to measure what the industry is doing today because it's hard to get a handle on what is actually background levels of hydrocarbon contamination when this is just a natural substrate eroding into the waterways. Most of it is buried under about 40 to 50 meters of muskeg and or geologic overburden. And so you can see the overburden material is removed, and then this is the ore, this is this dark colored ore in here, which is excavated by very large electric shovel excavators into the largest dump trucks in the world, heavy haulers, and transported away for upgrading. So it's a pretty incredible process. As far as land reclamation goes, the legislation in the province, it falls under the Environmental Protection and Enhancement Act, and that states a couple things that are important for for reclamation, for considerations of reclamation. So an industrial operator must conserve and reclaim specified materials. And those materials end up being surface materials, so the top meter of soil, and then the next 35 to 40 meters of overburden geologic material are salvaged and stockpiled. And the surface materials, the top meter of surface materials, are what I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk. And they are a peat material and an upland forest floor material. And so the overall distribution of ecosystems in this region is about 70% wetlands, 70% lowlands that are treed fens and bogs and accumulate peat over time, and 30% uplands. But given the nature of the disturbance, that is going to be reversed in the reclamation environment, will most likely be about 70% upland forest and 30% lowlands. And so in any reclamation situation, you have to use the materials you have at hand to rebuild your ecosystems, and that ends up being peat. So peat will be used in the reclamation environment in large quantities, but we'll see there might be some issues with that. The other one is they have to retain a reclamation certificate related to the capability, which is more of a productivity measurement of forest productivity. And to date, so, you know, there's been oil sands industrial development for the last 60 years, and to date there's only one certified reclaimed site in the whole region. And so earlier today we heard about 5 to 10 year bond releases for coal mines, and that's just not happening. It's nowhere near that here. And so that's one of the goals, I think, of reclamation R&D, is to get that certification process happening faster, to get these lands off the books for them. Some of the challenges include that it's an incredibly large area. So I mentioned that how many hectares have been disturbed so far. So you can just look at this picture here. It's landscape scale disturbance. This is just one mine. This is Syncrude's base mine operation, and it's probably 10 times the size of an average metal mine or coal mine. Another challenging material is difficult materials to work with. So the overburden material ends up being saline sodic material, so they want to bury that at depth and so that it doesn't affect plant growth or ecosystem development. And highly erodible materials, coarse texture materials that are erodible. And as we see, the two surface topsoils that we end up having for reclamation purposes might present a problem as well. So if we just talk about ecosystem development, we can think of a natural ecosystem as having pre-disturbance capability of A. So this is just an upland site. We're typically upland aspen spruce forests. And in the lowlands, we have black spruce as a treed fen or a bog species. And after this surface mine disturbance, we have a capability of zero. So as Jay was mentioning earlier, we basically heavy equipment takes away the plants, the vegetation, the topsoils, the overburden, and there's a hole in the ground with zero capability and zero ecosystem functionality. And so over time, we want to reclaim this ecosystem, and we want to get it onto a trajectory, ideally, to get it onto a trajectory where the reclaimed environment has post-disturbance capability of maybe A prime. So maybe not exactly the same as the natural site, because we're building these on anthroposols and we're changing the ecosystem dynamics, but A prime. So similar capability is what they talk about a lot in guidelines and approvals. So the R&D questions from our research partners is basically, can we define this trajectory? Can we look at sites after reclamation and tree planting and define the trajectory that they're on a sustainable ecosystem trajectory in a short period of time? And I would argue that right now the answer is no. We're looking at 25 to 50 years for reclamation certification. The other one is, can we optimize reclamation techniques at the landscape scale? In other words, are the techniques they're currently using the optimal techniques? And we'll see if that's true or not too. So we'll start off just looking at quickly looking at one reclamation case study. So this is the Aurora Capping Study. Is a new reclamation project that Syncrude built in the last couple of years. It's a completely random design of three replicates of 12 different treatments, and we'll just look at a subset of those treatments today. But this is an operational scale, an industrial operational scale reclamation environment. So this overall area is 35 hectares in size, and so each one of these cells is 1 hectare, and that represents sort of what an industrial operational reclamation treatment. And you can see right away, and so I changed this photograph, aerial photograph, is striking because the dark ones are the peat soils, and the light colored one are the upland forest floor soils. So there's already a striking difference in terms of the color of those treatments. And so this is graduate student's work. Mark Howell is a master's student in my lab, and he just looked at a subset of treatments. They're comparing the difference between deep and shallow placement of peat mineral mix versus deep and shallow placement of the forest floor mineral mix, and comparing that to a type of a control in the reclamation environment, which is just subsoil material with no surface capping material of organics, and comparing it to a benchmark site or a benchmark, or what we would like to think of was might be a benchmark of successful reclamation, and that is an alluviated district brunosol or an inceptibosol soil that just sort of natural soil horizonation, and we're looking at the sort of microbial profiles and nutrient dynamics in there. And so Mark basically excavated these about a bucket's worth of soil, built these bucket lysimeters, and then installed PRS probes and temperature and moisture gauges at 5, 15, and centimeter depth, and then put the bucket back in to try to maintain sort of moisture drainage and gas flux in that sampling area. And we're using, and we're going to focus on some new reclamation techniques I'll just mention quickly. Like PRS probes are an ionic resin analysis, so it's the probes are installed for 8 weeks over the course of the growing, or during the growing season, and they measure available in situ nutrition. And so more meaningful than, well, in situ nutrition, so different interpretation than what you would get from mineralization experiments or even just grab samples. That's one thing we're wrestling with a lot right now, too, is that the industrial partners use soil consultants in Alberta, and they're getting information. They're basing their successful or not successful reclamation on total carbon and nitrogen or grab sample fertility or just agronomic techniques that I don't believe work properly in this environment, and so we're trying to change their attitude about that as well. So we'll look at some, just so quickly, look at some data here. If we look at nutrient profiles, we have our different treatments on the x-axis, so we have deep peat and forest floor, shallow peat and forest floor, subsoil, and their natural site, and this is just for available nitrogen and available phosphorus, and I'm not really going to go into a lot of detail about the different depths, but I just want to make the point that they're the availability of nutrition is basically completely reversed for peat and forest floor. So peat has very high nitrogen content, and our forest floor and natural site have very low nitrogen availability versus peat has very low phosphorus availability, whereas our forest floor material and our natural soil has very high phosphorus availability. So the nutrient profile is opposite. And microbial biomass carbon, peat has very high biomass carbon, whereas our forest floor and is more similar to a harvested site. And then this is a community-level physiological profiling in ordination space. So just in ordination space, points that are close to each other are very similar microbial function versus points that are far away from each other. And so the green is our forest floor mineral mix, and the purple is harvested. So they're fairly similar to each other in terms of microbial function versus our peat is very far away from those. So we could argue that we're not... Well, perhaps we could argue that we're not on a sustainable trajectory at all. We're on a trajectory towards a novel ecosystem with post-disturbance capability B. Given that peat, if we're and specifically talking about peat, but given that peat is far more abundant than our upland forest floor mixture, right? Our upland forest floor is very much like our harvested soils. That's because that's basically where it came from. But there's far more peat, and the peat is their basically go-to reclamation substrate. And so if they keep using peat, in my opinion, they're on a trajectory towards a novel ecosystem with totally different capability or functionality. And so one thing we're trying to do in the lab is ask some questions about natural disturbance. So we can say peat is not an upland topsoil. Obviously, it formed in a wetland environment. It's not an upland topsoil. It's not necessarily the best thing to use. So what's the natural recovery from disturbance? How does that work? As another benchmark of success, so not just our harvested site, but another benchmark. And so fire is the natural disturbance in the area. It's stand replacing fires in the boreal, in the aspen spruce mix stands. And so, you know, there's a lot of similarities in some ways between fire and surface mining. It's a landscape scale process. But there's also sort of important ecological theory that we can apply to reclamation based on fire is a natural disturbance, and that is that species are adapted to fire. It's an evolutionary cue for fire. So this is a jackpine seedling, and of course jackpine have serotonous cones that only open after fire, and then they reestablish into the post-burn environment at 10,000 to 100,000 stems per hectare. too. And Aspen does the same thing. Aspen reestablishes in 100,000 stems per hectare from root suckers after fire. And currently where planting density is only 2,000 stems per hectare. So there's some things to learn from ecological theory that we're trying to apply to this. And so if we compare fire and reclamation, so I had another graduate student, Jill Martin, who is just wrapping up her work right now, and she looked at a chronosequence of fire sites. And so these are fire sites in the Aspen spruce stand, and these are, again, our alluviated brunosols, so inceptosols, and the other soil type that's prominent in the area are luvisols or alphasols. But these are brunosol soils, so how do what happens when we go from burn to an unburned stand, and how does that compare to reclamation? So you can see just, I included these soil profiles just to show you that the peat mineral mix creates a horizonation in there, but it's not from pedogenic processes, it's anthropogenically placed. And so these soils look very different too, right? You have a very dark peat layer, and then sometimes a heavier clay under subsurface layer or coarse textured material. So Jill and I went out and found a chronosequence. So this map is a GIS of historic fire distribution, and we went out and found a chronosequence of fire sites from 2 to 130 years since fire, and she lumped those into recently burned up to 40 years and unburned samples 70 to 130 years, and compared those to reclaimed sites where we have a range of sample of sites from 4 to 30 years since fire. And we use, again, ionic resin analysis, plant community ordination and PLFA ordinations to look at this data. And so I'll just go through this quickly again. These are NMS, the two top graphs are NMS ordination. So again, points that are close to each other are very similar. And this is the plant community in percent cover at the genus level. And we have green is our unburned, red is our burn sites, and blue is our reclaimed sites. And so it's interesting to note that we go from this fairly tight community in an unburned site. After burning, we have the introduction of post-disturbance species. There's more variability in that burned community. But it's very different, again, from the reclaimed community. If we look at PLFA now, so phospholipid fatty acids, so this is just microbial structure that we're looking at now. Again, red is burned, green is unburned, and blue is reclaimed. And again, you can see that there's the unburned sites fall within the burn site, so there's some increase in microbial diversity after fire. But once again, these are very different from what we're finding on the reclaimed sites. And on the bottom graph is just ammonium availability from our ionic resins along a chronosequence, and we can see the green here are natural forest floor, and the red are the reclaimed environment. So very different nutritional profiles, again, in peat mineral mixed reclamation environments. So it's not, again, more evidence that it's perhaps we're on a trajectory with, if we use peat, we're on a trajectory towards a novel ecosystem. And so the next question we're sort of asking, what is the legacy of disturbance? And I would suggest that the legacy of disturbance is charcoal, and we can think of it as a substrate legacy, sort of like a biological legacy, that the seed propagules and the root propagules are the biological legacy of fire, and that's where the plants come back from. We can think of charcoal as a substrate legacy that has been shown by some other work that we did to really affect the soil biogeochemical environment. So we did an experiment where we used isotope pool dilution, and then we sampled some different layers in soil columns for ammonium oxidizing bacteria and looked at real-time PCR. And what we found was that with increased fire frequency, there was more charcoal in the soil, and that led to more gross nitrogen mineralization and order of magnitude higher ammonium oxidizing bacteria. So just some evidence to suggest that it really does affect soil biogeochemical processes. And this is the sort of a scanning electron micrograph of charcoal. So it's full of surface area. These are the residual plant cell walls that have been thermally altered to black carbon. Full of surface area that is non-polar bonding capacity. So I think charcoal has been overlooked for some time because it's not contributing to the CEC of soils, but it has non-polar bonding capacity, massive non-polar bonding capacity, which modifies the organic chemical environment, DOC environment. And so we think it's an important legacy for, and an evolutionary cue for organisms that evolve in a pyrogenic ecosystem. The question then was, if we add different forms of black carbon to reclamation soils, does it change? Does it modify biogeochemistry? So again, we took our peat mineral mix and our forest floor mineral mix, and we added biochar. So this is a a man-made surrogate for charcoal through pyrolysis. You know, we just made this in a muffle furnace in the lab using woody feedstock and probably 500 degrees C pyrolysis conditions in a sand bath to limit oxygen. And we incubated this, and we used black carbon. And so this is an interesting waste product from the oil sands upgrading. This is petroleum coke. It's a black carbon substrate, but it's soot. It's not a combustion residue. It's a combustion condensate. And so it's a bit different from charcoal. It has some similar molecular structure, but different physical structure. But they have massive amounts of petroleum coke. And unlike heavy metal mining, it's not contaminated with heavy metals. It has some vanadium and a lot of sulfur. So can we use that as a reclamation substrate as well as a surrogate for fire? So we incubated these 150 days, 60% water holding capacity in these microlithimeters, and we looked at end mineralization and applied nonlinear regression to it and first order kinetic decomposition curve. And so I'll show you this data just quickly. The dots represent three replicates, represent the measured values over the 150 days in three replicates, and the line represents the first order kinetics model. And so what we can see here is that the dots, and the top graph is peat mineral mix and then forest floor mineral mix. We'll just focus on those two. And it's this total inorganic nitrogen, cumulative nitrogen over the 150 days. And we see that peat mineral doesn't follow the line very well. But then if we add biochar, it does. And so the suggestion is that that modifies decomposition parameters of biochar. So and then the forest floor follows first order kinetics immediately, and biochar makes it more linear, and it changes it. It reduces the amount of nitrogen mineralized. So it has an effect in the reclamation environment with our substrates. And so we're pursuing this to see how much of an effect, or if this works, if we can maybe use biochar as an amendment in our peat mineral mix soil to make it more like forest floor mineral mix. How much time do I have? None? Okay, so the last thing we're doing is we're using spatial patterns as maybe an index of variability or to look at patterns. So I missed that. Okay. And then I wanted to just summarize with some questions, which are, you know, can we, and that was what I'm getting at with the biochar. Can we build topsoil for use in the Athabasca oil sands? If we, and can we use substrate legacy like charcoal to improve soil function? If we build the right foundation, we get the right trajectory. And can we use spatial pattern recognition as a predictor of ecosystem recovery? That's the part I missed. If you want to talk about that later, I'd be happy to. I have a student who is looking at spatial patterns in the reclaimed environment giving a poster this afternoon at 4 o'clock, 2008. Thank you.